You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. How about you?
I couldn't be better. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. And I think you want them to check out the Discord, right?
We've got a Discord, a newly created Discord server for Non-Zero. The link is in the video description if you're watching this on YouTube. And I guess in the podcast
and in
description,
the show notes, if not, we think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're Nikita Petrov, as you know, also on the Non-Zero team. And we're going to talk about stuff, including what? We thought we'd start with Barry Weiss's takeover of all known media.
That seemed like a big story, yeah.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now we should say you are in Spain. You are from Russia. Is this whole thing puzzling to you, or?
Yeah. The last few years have been very puzzling for me in almost every area that news cover. This one, well, let me show you this. This is the two narratives that I've seen in different ways presented about the acquisition.
So, if people don't know, the owner of Paramount, new owner of Paramount, who's the son of Larry Ellison, billionaire, founder of Oracle, has, in his capacity as guy running CBS, which Paramount owns, bought the Free Press, Barry Weiss's media creation, started out as a Substack newsletter for $140 million. That'll be part of CBS or something. Anyway, she's going to be the editorial director of CBS, which I'm sure Edward R. Murrow would be happy to hear were he with us. And that's that story. Sorry. Go ahead. You're going to show me. That tweet. That's funny. I'd seen that tweet.
Yeah. So this is the
actually, I saw there's also a meta tweet for that. So there's that tweet and then somebody quote tweeted it and I'll get back to that. But go ahead and tell us what's in that tweet.
So this is an exchange between Chris Best, the co-founder of Substack, and Paul Graham, mm-hmm. who you know more about than I do. I just follow him on Twitter and read a few of his essays, but he's the Y Combinator guy, right?
Founder.
Mm-hmm.
And he unleashed Sam Altman on the world. But we all make mistakes. You know, he's a very smart and successful guy. Right. Anyway.
And so Chris, the co-founder of Substack, says the Free Press has just got bought for a reported $150 million, and he congratulates Barry Weiss on this and presents it as it's a massive outcome that expands what seems possible for ambitious media founders. You can start a Substack, and in a few years, you get $150 million because you build this little media empire.
Well, that's the way it's worked for me. I mean, so me and Barry, that's two people. It works.
And then Paul says, surely this is an anomaly. They got bought as part of a plan to control the U.S. media, not for their revenue growth. Chris replies, whose plan? And Paul does not respond to this. But I've got another tweet from Glenn Greenwald. This is before Free Press acquisition, I guess, but the conversation was already happening. And I think it has more to do with TikTok, the conversation about the TikTok purchase. And he says that...
Which, by the way, Ellison is also involved in.
Because
Oracle has long had this, for a while, association with TikTok. And then Trump created, and this involved violating the law, but never mind, because he was supposed to just kind of shut TikTok down according to the law. But he is creating this American version of TikTok. And Larry Ellison and these various other people are going to be investors and kind of running it. Sorry. Go ahead.
Right. And so Greenwald's description of this situation is Larry Ellison, the mega billionaire Oracle founder and the IDF's largest private donor, is now taking control of CBS, Paramount, TikTok, and likely CNN. I don't know what CNN refers to actually here.
I don't know. He said likely CNN. I guess that's
likely,
ordered to be next on the agenda.
So this is a narrative that I'm starting to hear. Israel controlling American media, and it sounds eerily similar to like the most lowbrow caricature cartoons that I've seen 20 years ago about Jewish control of world media. But it also seems to be rooted in reality. So if you can explain this to me.
Actually, you just conflated Israel and Jews, but I'll get back to that. Let me read one more tweet, which quote tweeted the Chris Best exchange with Paul Graham or Paul Graham's reply. And maybe back into it that way. And this also gives me a chance to get nitpicky and complain about something not necessarily related to this. But okay, so Mike Solana, who's this big Silicon Valley guy, is he a co-founder of Founders Fund or something? Peter Thiel's VC fund. He's a Peter Thiel guy. A lot of Twitter followers, big guy, I guess. So he says about Paul Graham. Paul Graham's quote. Paul Graham, again, says, surely this is an anomaly. They got bought as part of a plan to control the U.S. media, not for their revenue growth. Mike Solana says, such a fascinating take to Paul. We should say, Graham is one of the few people in Silicon Valley who has criticized Israel for a long time. Mike Solana is emphatically not, I gather. He says, such a fascinating take. Who is, quote, they controlling the media here? Is it CBS, which already controls CBS? Is it Barry, who I guess convinced CBS to buy them in order to control CBS? Or is the, quote, they in question here somewhere, someone else? In other words, he means, is they the Jews? Okay, first of all, the nitpicky part. It's clear who they refers to. It says they got bought as part of a plan to control the U.S. media, not for their revenue growth. It refers to the free press. There's no ambiguity whatsoever. And yet this triggered a whole massive discussion of speculation. What does they refer to? That part's clear. Okay. Sorry. But I mean, nobody reads tweets before replying to them. That said, it's a perfectly valid question. What's he insinuating? Who is he saying is controlling the media? Although I will say that by acting as if Graham had said, quote, they control the media, he's steering you towards a Jews interpretation and not an Israel interpretation or an Israel lobby interpretation. Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a tendentious misreading of the thing. Again, hate to be nitpicky. So what's going on here is, Paul Graham is saying the Israel lobby, broadly speaking, in the Walt Mearsheimer sense of a network of pro-Israel groups who might sometimes loosely coordinate and sometimes not at all, and some elements of it never coordinate, whatever. You know, it's just, they're not, in other words, they're not just talking about AIPAC, and they're not talking about Israel, per se. He's not saying, I think he's talking about the lobby, broadly speaking. And Glenn Greenwald is affirming that and saying it's true, basically, right? And, not in so many words, but I think that's what he'd say. And, okay, so what is the truth about this? We'll get to the bottom of this, Nikita. Stay with me and interrupt me at any point with questions.
Let's go, explain this to me.
Or if I just start seeming out of control, like I'm going to get canceled or something, interrupt. So I think it's true that by conventional reckoning, and I guess the number is 150 million, not 140, as I said, if Chris is right. But by conventional reckoning, you would not pay that for a free press. We don't have their financials, but I'd be surprised if they're in the black, honestly. I mean, remember, they got massive investment from Silicon Valley billionaires who I would say are investing on ideological grounds. And the question is, which ideological grounds? And this is where it gets a little complicated, because I do think the investors have various ideological motivations. Remember, Barry Weiss, she is, I would say, the center of her political identity. If you look at her whole history, I'll get into that, is pro-Israel. But she's also anti-woke. Mm-hmm. There's also irony there, by the way, that I may have time to get into, but she is. So like David Sachs invested in Free Press. I don't think he's ardently pro-Israel. I really don't. I think for him, it's more like wokeness and just conservative, right? He wants low taxes, low regulation, and he wants wokeness to die. And I really don't think for him it was about Israel. Now, Andreessen Horowitz, I think, shares all those sentiments, and there may or may not be pro-Israel stuff going on there, but they invested in Free Press. So, first of all, I think without all that investment money, Free Press, you know, never would have gotten off the ground. I personally doubt it's making money. This is not a business model that is famously lucrative right now. In any event, I mean, it is, as people have noted, the Horowitz in Andreessen is the son of an ardently pro-Israel white right-wing guy named David Horowitz, but I don't know anything about the son's ideology, and maybe that's on record. I haven't done my research, so I'm agnostic on all that. Now, the Ellison is another story. Larry Ellison, yes, ardently pro-Israel. I don't know anything about his son, but obviously this whole thing doesn't go through without Larry liking it, right? And Larry is the one involved with TikTok. And in the Non-Zero newsletter last week, as you know, we had a little item basically based on this piece in the American Conservative about how all the people who are or are reported to be investing in the new America TikTok are either reliably or passionately pro-Israel. And there's other stuff in the American Conservative piece indicating, yes, a clearly pro-Israel slant. Since then, pro-Israel infrastructure personnel, let's say, including staff. But since then, Bibi Netanyahu, I think it's since then, I heard it since then, was recorded talking to social media influencers saying, if this TikTok purchase goes through, that's going to be good for us. And
I've got
now
that exact clip ready.
Yeah. Okay. Well, and now let's set our sights on Twitter, right?
Yeah. Let me play this. And,
okay.
We have to fight with the weapons that apply to the battlefields in which we're engaged. And the most important ones are in social media. And the most important purchase that is going on right now is class.
Followers.
TikTok. Oh. TikTok. Number one. And I hope it goes through because it's it can be consequential. Mm-hmm. And the other one, what's the other one that's most important?
X.
X. That's very good. And, you know, so we have to talk to Elon. He's not an enemy. He's a friend. We should talk to him. Now, if we can get those two things, we get a lot. And I could go on other things, but that's not the point right now. We have to fight the fight, okay? To give direction to the Jewish people and give direction to our non-Jewish friends or those who could be our Jewish our friends.
Direction? I mean, it's so funny. It's like, you're not supposed to say, you know, they're trying to manipulate us. And he said, he didn't even say orientation. He's like, direction. We're going to tell them, you know. So interesting side note, Michelle Goldberg had a column today, which she said, I didn't know this. I mean, I knew that Charlie Kirk, you know, a month or so before he died, pro-Israel people, including Bill Ackman, put pressure on him to quit, like seeming to flirt with an anti-Israel or anti-Zionist stance or whatever. He resisted that. That led to rumors that, you know, Israel had him assassinated. I think that's nuts. But the thing Michelle reported was that some donor said to Kirk at this meeting, there was they staged an intervention with Kirk, apparently, pro-Israel, some pro-Israel people. And it did not work out well, I gather. But one of them said he was going to withdraw a $2 million grant he had given to Kirk, unless Kirk cut his ties with Tucker Carlson, who is really going after Israel lobby influence on the media big time. Listen to the long preamble to his recent interview with Jeffrey Sachs. The reason that came to mind is Twitter would be a pressure point for Tucker Carlson. It's like, you know, he's not on an MSM platform in the traditional sense. But he's on YouTube, owned by Google. He relies on Twitter, I think, for a lot of traffic, right? And, you know, and I was wondering, well, what can they do to Tucker Carlson? And I guess you can imagine. But anyway, yeah, I mean, look, the again, Barry Weiss's the center of her identity is pro-Israel. I would, you know, I went back and I remember this piece I wrote on Non-Zero called "Why Is Everyone So Mean to Barry Weiss?"
Mm-hmm.
I just read it. It has great art by you. This is 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I would encourage people to Google it. You Google that phrase in quotes plus Non-Zero, you'll see it. I think it holds up pretty well. It explains, first of all, the ridiculous paradox of her crusading for free speech and against cancellation when she spends a certain amount of time trying to cancel people and suppress speech by calling them anti-Semitic. Now, you know, she might say, you know, well, that's because they're anti-Semitic. Well, the woke people have their things. They say they're anti-trans, they're anti-gay, they're racist, whatever. And you can argue about their definitions of that. And you can argue about Barry Weiss's because she says that if you're opposed to Zionism, you're an anti-Semite. Okay. Which means like all kinds of Jewish people are anti-Semites, according to her. And you know, she thinks that, you know, she calls them that so as a way of silencing them. And I'm sorry, there's just a little bit of tension between her attitude toward woke speech and her attitude toward her speech. So, yeah, it's her whole kind of, I mean, it's the heart of her political identity. And the Ellison thing, you know, I didn't know that thing that Glenn said. What did he say? Larry Ellison's the biggest private donor to Israel's military.
That's what he says.
Yeah, there's other stuff. I don't really know much about his son per se, but, you know, this obviously has Larry Ellison's approval. Yeah, it cannot not be the case that CBS is about to take a turn toward the pro-Israel. And I think this has been underplayed in the media. I mean, the Washington Post did a long story on the Ellisons and Paramount and CBS and Barry Weiss. And the word Israel appeared once, like kind of in passing. Oh, also, all three support Israel. No, it goes beyond that. I mean, you know, this is like Barry Weiss's mission in life.
So how big of a portion of the U.S. media is this, are we talking about? Like, remember, I'm Russian. In my context, free media not controlled by the government, that's a short period in my country's history. And I remember, like, this TV channel is owned by this one oligarch, the other is owned by this other one. They battle it out.
Yeah.
What I'm hearing now about the US, like, I can't make heads of or tails of it, whether you've got free media with a lot of private you know, billionaires, like private individuals and corporations, and it's just like a complex landscape of interest, or Israel is about to control the U.S. media. Is that anywhere close to reality?
No, that's not anywhere close. You know, because, yeah, you add up CBS and the free press and even Paramount and what they can do with movies and whatever else they'll buy. It's not like a majority of the media landscape. Now, there is a lot of support in U.S. media for Israel, you know, and I would say at this point, kind of, how would you characterize it? Not just like, yeah, I wish Israel well, but yeah, we're with Bibi, which is pretty fucking extreme, right? Sorry about the language. Right now, given the thing in Gaza and I mean, everything there, you know, Israel's been on a total rampage militarily in the region by its own standards, by any recent standards, I would say in world history, honestly. So to support the government now, it's pretty extreme. And there's a fair amount of, it's not so much active support in the media. It can take such subtle forms. Even like this recent, you know, I think it was the New York Times piece, Wall Street Journal piece, is like, you know, political constraints Bibi Netanyahu faces about Gaza. Why it's hard for him to do a ceasefire. You always hear the stories about Israel. You never see them about the Palestinian side. But constraints always exist. Believe it or not, you know, Yasser Arafat had them, leader of Hamas had them, and so on. So it can be, that's not even conscious, I don't think. That's just like looking at Israel as like kind of our ally, kind of like us, and just the Palestinians as this kind of alien thing, like they just kill people. We have political constraints. I don't know, but it assumes a lot of forms. But no, it's not Israel. It's not. And I wouldn't have, Paul Graham used the word control.
Right. That's why I'm bringing this up. Yeah.
I would say they want to expand the influence of a strongly pro-Israel perspective. And one reason I say it's being underplayed by the media's coverage of this is like, I mean, look at Gaza. It's not like this happened 10 years ago and you get CBS falls into strongly pro-Israel hands. I mean, come on, this is a big issue of our times. Looks pretty horrific to me. It's U.S. tax dollars paying for what's happening in Gaza. We're giving them the weapons. I would say the underplaying of the fairly obvious ideological agenda here is itself a sign of, an imbalance of perspective in American media. Not that it's always coming from these people who are even thinking of themselves as pro-Israel. It just, it's just an imbalance. And there is still, this is the thing there's the most reluctance to still talk about, okay, in the realm of the Israel speech code. Used to be you couldn't say apartheid, you can say that. Originally, nobody was calling it genocide. Now, Marjorie Taylor Greene's calling it genocide, and lots and lots of people are. But the thing about pro-Israel influence in the media is the closest thing to a line you're not supposed to cross. And that's why Tucker Carlson is getting blowback and will continue. And this one guy was willing to use $2 million worth of leverage to get Charlie Kirk to cut ties with Tucker, according to what Michelle Goldberg said today. I hadn't seen that report, but she's, Michelle's reliable. I don't know what else. I really would ask people to, do I often engage in self-promotion? Makedia, you tell me.
Very reluctantly.
Very reluctantly. In fact, I'm at this very moment, someone has a gun to my head, but I would encourage people to Google that. Why is everyone so mean to Barry Weiss? If you think it's worth, it was non-zero. If you think it's worth sharing, share it. It's a very calm assessment of the paradoxes of her worldview and the way this whole issue is processed in America. And I said at the time, 5 years ago, this makes it more likely that we will wind up in war with Iran. Well, we've now attacked Iran. It was not the kind of, so far, not the kind of war I had feared. But what else can I answer for you today, Nikita?
Honestly, my questions are so basic, I feel ashamed bringing them up. This whole, Israel hasn't really been on my map of things to follow until the current crisis in Gaza. But since then, this has become such a huge part of this American discourse with which I have to be associated with. And I can't figure any of it out. Is the U.S. relationship with Israel a wholly special relationship that doesn't have other, is the U.S. the only ally of this sort of Israel's? And if so, why?
Well, I mean, it's by far the most powerful and important ally. Yes. And I mean, if you just look at, Britain, France, Spain, America, can you name the one that hasn't recognized Palestine as a state? Yeah. I mean, we stand out. But I would say qualitatively, the idea of a lobby like this, that is shaped, and first of all, I want to stress the Israel lobby, in America, it certainly doesn't include all Jews in America. And it doesn't include only Jews in America. You know, the Christian evangelicals are considered, and they, and some of their leaders are considered an important part of the lobby. And that's why Tucker is a problem for them. Because Tucker Carlson, I don't know him personally, but I've seen so many of his rants that I call him Tucker. It's as if he's delivering them in person. They're so forceful. He's making an explicitly Christian. I mean, he says things that make me uncomfortable sometimes. And that's kind of one of them. But it's his audience, you know. And he's going for it. And that's why, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene is involved. And now Megyn Kelly, kind of. And so that's a big source of concern. Because, look, Bibi's lost a lot of younger Jews in America. If he loses the conservative Christian evangelicals, if Israel does in the long run, that's a problem. So anyway, where was I going? I was saying, you know, let's be clear on what the Israel lobby is and isn't. It is shaped by ethnic identity in America and, to some extent, by people who feel warmly toward another nation. Well, that's not unique in America. I mean, the reason we expanded NATO is so Clinton could get some Polish American and other Eastern European American votes, you know, plus arms lobbies and so on. Look, the reason we're bombing boats in from Venezuela right now is probably, I'm guessing, without the Cuba lobby, this would not be happening. I mean, that's what Marco Rubio has these kinds of connections. He's probably more than anyone driving this policy. And that's been, the Cuba lobby has been incredibly influential, in a way more puzzlingly than the Israel lobby. There's kind of a Taiwan lobby. It's not a unique thing, but yes, very influential and in a way that's very consequential. And I would say just plainly at odds with American interests. I mean, you just can't tell me this Gaza thing is good for America. It increases the chance of terrorism on our soil. There's nothing good for us about this. And we have the leverage to stop it because we supply the weapons. And if you ask, well, why don't we stop it? Part of the answer is this degree of political influence, some of which comes through the media. Yeah.
Is this lobby, how unique is the system of lobbies that the U.S. has in the world?
That's a good question.
I've heard somewhere explained to me like the why the nothing is happening to. I think it's probably a too simplistic of an explanation, but one of the themes of a conversation, I forget where I heard this, but the gun lobby, NRA, was brought up as an example of like it's hard to control the American system broadly, but if you have one specific interest and you have enough money, you can like carve out that specific thing and make sure the country doesn't change on a particular issue. And NRA was brought up as an example. And I've heard a lot about this lobby, that lobby, but I don't understand how, I don't have like a visualization of how it all works. Is Qatar a huge force in the U.S., like I hear from some people, investing in universities?
Not a big enough force to keep itself from being bombed by Israel. No, I mean, they try. They bought Trump a whole airliner, and he can't keep Israel from attacking them, even though we have an American base there. I mean, this is extraordinary. You know, it's like you do need an explanation when you've got a country that we have immense leverage over, in theory, doing things so at odds with our interests. You need an explanation. It like can't be that there's not, in some sense, influence, right? I mean, American policy is being influenced in otherwise puzzling ways, right? So, Qatar, there has been more Gulf state influence generally, including even like in think tanks and stuff. Qatar, you know, they punch above their weight. It's a small country, and they've been influential. The NRA has been very powerful. By the way, there's also a pro-Ukraine lobby. I mean, to some extent, you know, ethnically Ukrainian people have, in organized form, have had at least some influence on policy, not vast, but the NRA, very powerful, not ethnic, but one thing it has in common with the Israel lobby is, like, they will punish politicians for straying, and you know, the Israel lobby has in a few cases done it consequentially, you know, ended the careers of people in Congress.
Well, is that a bug or a feature? Is that just how the American system works? You've got, like, money is and organized interest groups is how the system coheres.
You've always had I think you've always had money. Some things have changed. You know, Citizens United ruling by the Supreme Court permitted massive expenditures to influence campaigns in a particular way. And I think, you know, and wealth, I think, is getting, you know, I mean, income has gotten less equal. I think the distribution of wealth has. And so it's more like an oligarchy, I think, pretty clearly, especially in recent years. It's not good. It's not good. And
but, like, was it not the case 50 years ago? You didn't have an oligarchy, and now you feel like you're inching towards it?
Money has always been, you know, rich people, I would assume, in every society are disproportionately powerful, and they've always been. There was not a powerful Israel lobby 40 years ago, 50 years ago, I would say. Dwight Eisenhower didn't seem to feel constrained by what Israel wanted. Of course, that was more like 60, 70. But even, you know, the first Bush, George H.W. Bush. It's always, I mean, you know, there's money talks, and it always has. And I'm not enough of an historian to be able to compare this broadly with, America, look, it was created by guys who owned land, and many didn't, you know, and that's the world we live in. It's not great.
Let me play you a Trump clip on TikTok, and the question here. So we've been talking about Israel's influence, but that's just one of the things to look at. There's also, like, this administration's influence over media, right? This is a curious moment in one of the Trump's interactions with the press.
Now that Americans will have operational control, do you want to see the algorithm suggest more MAGA-related content prioritized?
I always like MAGA-related. If I could, I'd make it 100% MAGA-related. It's actually a good question, but I would, yeah. If I could make it 100% MAGA, I would, but it's not going to work out that way, unfortunately. No, everyone's going to be treated fairly. Every group, every philosophy, every policy will be treated very fairly.
So he says if he could, he would make it 100% MAGA related. Why can't he?
Well, first of all, I want to say, I think that's to his supporters, that's part of his charm. And that's what, you know, like, there will be some places, God knows, some blogs, maybe some MSM, where the headline is Trump says if he could make it 100% MAGA related, he would, right? But it's kind of the jokey honesty of that part that some people find charming. And then if you listen, he says, no, everyone will be treated fairly. First of all, if we're talking about TikTok, it's not just about the algorithm. It's not, you know, per se. It's about, what's the term? Trust and safety. In other words, the speech police. These social media they can take down accounts. They can take specific posts and accounts and subdue them within the algorithm. In that sense, it's about the algorithm. you know, one thing that the American conservative piece noted is that apparently one of the important TikTok people already is this strongly pro-Israel person. And that's new. It was in, you know, if you remember the way this unfolded, at first there was this, you know, all this fear about Chinese influence on TikTok. And then that kind of petered out. And then Gaza started, and then people in Congress started complaining about pro-Hamas bias on TikTok. And that became the big thing, which isn't that shocking, given TikTok's demographic? You know, you don't have to, like, imagine a conspiracy. It's you know, you have a lot of very young people. I don't mean a lot of young people are pro-Hamas per se. I mean, that was like a caricature of them, but they're pro-Palestinian. Since then, I think the trust and safety has already moved, according to this article in Tower, or it suggests that it's moved in a pro-Israel direction. Look, the algorithm, there are all kinds of ways you can bias the speech if you want, if you've got control. I think there's some sense in which ByteDance is going to still control the algorithm in its most generic sense, but still, that's there will be plenty of things that you know, people at the top of TikTok can do to bias speech on TikTok, and I believe they will with respect to Israel. I mean, I don't know if I you know, if I were a billionaire, I wouldn't spend all this money unless I was getting something for it. And, you know, all the billionaires in question seem to have one thing in common. So
I saw Trump on TikTok talking to me, the TikTok audience, saying, "I saved TikTok. You're welcome." So, I mean, are you worried about the bias just within domestic American policy that the algorithm will change to favor one political party?
You know, I would guess it would also work. I mean, these are conservative investors too. Yeah, so it could well, or at a minimum, certain things on the left that they find particularly annoying may have less of a voice, I would think. And look, they would say this was happening on the other side. You know, we now know that
the Biden
administration was exerting kinds of influence. Now, some of them, you know, were about like pandemic policy, but that's ideology in a sense. And there was also foreign policy stuff going on. Who did this?
And domestically, I mean, there was the laptop story, right? The Hunter Biden laptop.
Right. Well, now that's a good example. That is partisan. I mean, they have their side of the story. And they would say, you guys started it. And you know, it's like the Israel-Palestine conflict. You can go back forever and they say, but before we did this, you did that.
Right. Well, so that's kind of my question. Like, is what we're discussing here just sort of the ebb and flow of the American system? Like, you're just going to have these, you know, this billionaire buys this newspaper and then it gets acquired by a different one 20 years down the road. And it's just how it plays out. You're just watching this game.
Well, I mean, again, you know, it is not, you know, I mean, William Hurst is apparently, right, I gather, helped get us into the, helped start the Spanish-American War or something. I'm not an expert. You know, so it's been going on a long time. And there's always, even when it was not so much an oligarchy and it wasn't so much billionaires, there was always a connection between media and the elite establishment, right? And that's played out in various ways. And in some ways, I mean, it's funny. This is what this is, I guess. I think originally people thought the internet was going to kind of change that forever. And there was going to be this just decentralizing influence. Anybody can start a blog. To me, what it now looks like more is that it's a period of rapid transition. And these transitions keep happening. So you move to blogs and then, you know, you got Substacks and you got YouTube creators and you got social media. And every time there is a decentralizing effect and all these new people arise that you can't control, the establishment finds a way to start consolidating control. And in a way, that's the most interesting thing about this.
Mm-hmm.
I thought Free Press was a Substack, just this one person. You know, I thought Substack was going to let 1,000 flowers bloom. Well, no. These investors from Silicon Valley supported this one person, built it up into this big thing. This other billionaire is going to make it a bigger thing. And, you know, these thousand flowers keep not blooming for long.
You can, like, you still can start a Substack. How much of a bigger piece of a pie you can have, like, you're going to have, but you have a chance, right?
I would say less than when I started mine. And I would say it's getting harder, partly because of one billionaire, Elon Musk, suddenly decided, no, you can't put URLs in tweets or they won't get any action. That, you know, as you know, Nikita, that's been a big problem for us and many other Substack newsletters.
Right.
Very big problem. And that's like one billionaire who seems crazy as a loon. And he certainly has his ideology.
Are you
trying to think of something encouraging?
something tells me my next question is not going to lead to more encouraging things, but are you hopeful about the peace negotiations in Gaza?
I don't, you know, not very. I mean, I would need to know how likely peace is to endure, how likely this is to end. I'd need to know how desperate Hamas's situation is on the ground, A, how much leverage the Arab states are putting on them, B, and why the Arab states are doing it. But this is, you know, I was talking to a guy yesterday who knows a lot about this shit. You know, it was a private conversation. I won't tell you who he is, but he was at a think tank for a while, and now he's something else, and he's, you know, knows a lot about the Middle East. And I said, well, why are these Arab states putting the pressure on Hamas? And he said, well, you know, Qatar doesn't want to get bombed again. Israel just bombed them. Mm-hmm. Turkey is afraid that Israel will play the Kurdish card, which is to say incite Kurdish insurrection within, you know, I mean, Turkey already has a problem with Kurds. Apparently, I guess Israel has signaled in some way I didn't understand that they're willing to play that card. And then Egypt is worried that Israel will, I guess, in the Camp David Accords. I don't know enough to say who that would hurt more between Egypt and Israel. Apparently, Egypt thinks it's a credible threat. According to this guy, knows a lot. And so, again, Israel, you know, and let's be clear, two of those three things are like really, you know, breaking the rules, right? Attacking another country, arming whatever rebels are doing, whatever they would do inside Turkey. So I would need to know that, because otherwise, I mean, unless Hamas is desperate, having a lot of pressure put on them, you wouldn't think. I mean, what Trump is currently asking, I gather, and certainly Israel is, okay, first release all the hostages, and then we're going to guarantee, and Israel's not going to withdraw very far, not anywhere near the borders of Gaza, but trust us, all this other stuff will happen. Why would anyone trust Trump or Bibi about anything? But in this specific context, remember that at the time Israel bombed Iran, there were negotiations, very active negotiations going on between Iran and the U.S. about resolving the nuclear thing peacefully. Israel bombs them, puts an end to that, and Trump then signals that, yeah, he was in on it. There wasn't this clever. And now Trump and Bibi are like, okay, but trust us. You know, it's just so again, I mean, Hamas.
Do you buy that Trump was in on it?
Well, I buy that if I was Hamas or anyone else, I would err on the side of yes. Right. I mean, that's the way you look at these things. If you're the one who has the most to lose, if Trump is telling the truth. Well, look, Trump is just famous for reneging on deals. He did this in the business world. Like I was talking to somebody whose father did business with him. He said the thing about Trump is you cannot deliver the final bit of the goods or services until he has paid you all the money. Because if you deliver everything, he'll just say, no, I'm not giving you the rest of the money. I don't care what the contract says. So, Hamas would have to be in pretty, either under a huge amount of pressure, and look, these states have the leverage, I guess, collectively, because Hamas has to get support from somewhere, or just in a very dire situation on the ground in Gaza, to do what is currently being demanded of them. But, you know, if Trump really wants peace to happen, he might sustain these negotiations. Again, we do have the leverage with Israel, if he wants to use it. And apparently he is starting to play a little bit of hardball. So he could, you know, could be that this evolves into something that works. But the current demands assume that Hamas is just completely desperate. Or
right. And Hamas, what Hamas gets out of this proposed deal is just that they're going to be, you know, let go, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, they say they'll let them leave the country or stay there and give them amnesty. Again, you'd be crazy to trust Israel on the amnesty part, right? I mean, you could. I mean, they won't. As a practical matter, if I'm in their shoes, I'm thinking, no, I could wind up in prison if I stay in Gaza. I'm leaving Gaza if I don't want to be in prison. Because again, I mean, Bibi is as untrustworthy as Trump, which is saying something.
Do you have any?
But yeah, that's the offer. I mean, I do think they have the chance to not get killed, and that can be pretty appealing. That's why I say if they're in a really desperate situation on the ground, and Israel really can come in and kill them all, I'd give it some pretty serious thought if I were them.
Here's a take I heard. Hamas already won. It's just going to take 40 years to manifest. And the whole, like, their end game, the whole reason for the October 7 attack was to provoke an overreaction that would then destroy Israel's reputation in the world and diminish its stature in the world. And they're playing the long game, and it's religious fanatics who are willing to sacrifice their lives to be seen as heroes by their descendants. I'm giving this as an example. This is like a take I heard from a guy. But do you have a theory of mind of Hamas? What was their goal when they launched the attack?
I think it's nonsense that like this was their plan. I mean, I don't think Sinwar planned on being dead. I had a podcast conversation with Rob Malley, long time involved in negotiations. He was at Camp David on the U.S. team. Very smart, reasonable guy. He says he thinks Sinwar's main aim was just to get hostages, because traditionally Israeli hostages have been huge leverage. You remember,
okay,
Israel traded 1,000 prisoners for one guy, one soldier. And Sinwar himself was in an Israeli prison. And I think there was a swap that got him out. And apparently at the time, I think Rob said something to the effect that, like, at the time he said, I'm going to get a lot more of these guys out. Now, that wasn't his only aim, but this was Israel always responds disproportionately in terms of number of casualties. But this is like, you know, adding a zero to the ratio almost. You can understand how he did not expect it to go on this long and kill this many people, including him.
Okay.
No, I mean, look, do I think all of this may come back to haunt Israel? Sure. Tons of, males in Gaza between the ages of, 10 and 16. I mean, many of the older ones have been killed. I mean, Rob said the targeting criterion is if they're male, they look old, they look like 18 or so, or that you think, whatever you think they're, you know, you kill them. It's not, they're not wearing uniforms, just kill the males. And so, but there are younger ones. And most of them, I would say, have a family member who has been killed or maimed by Israel. If you define family to go out to cousins, certainly. And that could come back to haunt Israel in all kinds of ways and come back to haunt America because we're providing the weapons. But this was not the plan. This was not Sinwar's plan. What's happened? So, whew. Thank you for letting me go on. But I need a nap now. it's time for Bob's nap. No. So what else? I mean, how long have we been doing this? Is it overtime?
I've been doing this for
time?
About 15 minutes. I think we can go into overtime. I had much more abstract and generic questions about, like, cognitive sovereignty is a term that you've used. So it's moving more into the non-zero world, non-zero community / movement building territory. But I don't know if there's something in the news that your government is in a shutdown. Like, I find myself... Do you remember then Prigozhin marched on Moscow?
Oh, yeah.
It's this huge reversal, huge thing. A guy takes his private army that has been fighting in Ukraine for some time and just reverses course, takes one town after another. One of these cities was a bigger city, Rostov-on-Don, where a family of a friend of mine lived. And that guy was in Russia at the time, unlike most of my friends. And I remember, like, I was really invested. I was following, like, this weird thing just started happening. And, you know, is there going to be a civil war? Is there going to be a coup? What's going to happen? And I remember this guy's reaction was, when something happens, let me know. Because I'm tired of watching this fucking soap opera. And he's, like, tanks are in the center of the city where his family lives. You know, led by this rogue commander who's about to go on Moscow. And at the time, I felt like you're really trying to isolate yourself from the world you live in. Mm-hmm. But then, like, 2 days later, nothing happened. Lukashenko called them, and somehow it all resolved. Now Prigozhin doesn't exist anymore, allegedly.
Is there a theory that he actually lives?
There, of course, there's a theory that he lives. It's kind of petered down now, but at the time, like the first however many months since then, occasionally you would see, it was mostly funny, but like people would post pictures like this dude in the bus looks suspiciously similar to Prigozhin. But there is my favorite piece of folklore on this. Actually, like this is just a fact that I don't know what to do with it, except that it seems poetically interesting. So there was a funeral. It was a closed funeral. Nobody was allowed to get into the graveyard. It was surrounded by the police, and they stayed overnight. And in the morning, the entrance was allowed again. And after that closed funeral, if you went to his grave, there was like a wooden cross, I think a picture of Prigozhin, which is normal for a fresh grave. And then there was a poem from this famous Russian Soviet poet, Joseph Brodsky. And the poem it's an excerpt from a longer poem, which I happen to know. I really like that poet. And the poem is painting a picture of Mother Mary, Virgin Mary, right? Mother of God at the cross talking to her son, asking, after he was dead, asking, are you man or God? Meaning, are you dead or alive?
Mm-hmm.
So like the people, like this is the government that put that poem at the cross. This is them planting the seed. Like nobody saw the body, right? I guess there's no body.
Do you think the government wants there to be Prigozhin truthers?
I mean, why else would you put that? I mean, maybe it's just like playful. Maybe.
But how does it help them?
I mean,
then people can say, oh, I don't think Putin had him killed. Putin wouldn't do that, or what?
I mean, one of the consequences of that kind of conspiracy theorizing, nothing you see is true. Nothing you see is real.
Yeah.
Whoever is in power is going to stay in power. Whether it's Putin, or maybe Putin does not exist and it's actually a shadowy cabal of people you've never seen, but whoever they are, you've got no levers to pull.
No.
There is no, you know, you can, when you see an attempt at a coup and their armies are being moved, even that is all theater. And you just, you know, watch your TV, go about your business, do your work. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, I mean, people who've lived in very authoritarian countries, even borderline totalitarian, I guess, some of them say that, like, part of the game is just, you know, gaslighting you. I guess it's getting you to a point where you don't know what to believe.
Right.
I don't know. I guess that's true. They know what they're doing. But I want to, you know, I've got this, there's this part of my brain that, like, 15 minutes after I say something that could be misconstrued to my disadvantage, like, injects it into my consciousness.
Uh-huh.
I want to say the thing, Anna is very active when I'm talking about Israel from past and bitter experience. But, you know, when I said if I were a billionaire, you know, I'd want something out of my investment in TikTok, and all these billionaires have something in common. I didn't mean they're Jewish. Rupert Murdoch is one of them, but he's been reliably pro-Israel. And of course, there are, you know, Jewish billionaires and so, who aren't pro-Israel. I just meant they are all the people named as big investors in TikTok, speculatively not, have a history of manifestly being reliably pro-Israel. So should we could talk more about Prigozhin truthers and stuff, but we should probably go into overtime. We want to talk about this movie, One Battle After Another, right? Which I saw last night. You saw. We have different views of it, I think.
Talk about that. We can talk. I want you to go on, give me a pitch for the term cognitive sovereignty that I've heard you use a bunch of times, but I've never heard you really like flesh it out.
Now, do you mean cognitive empathy or cognitive sovereignty? I've started
cognitive
using
sovereignty.
Yeah.
The empathy, that bit I know, the cognitive empathy thing, that sermon I've heard.
Yeah. sounds like you still enjoy them. Sounds like you just can't get too much of it. Yeah, the idea there is, and I didn't originate the term, and I've only seen it a few places on social media, but the context I saw it in, and I'm writing about this in the book that comes out next year on AI, but you know, with like various algorithms, as a rule, AI driven, ranging from social media to algorithms to like large language models themselves, exerting more influence on us, you know, preserve your like freedom, your autonomy, like make sure you're not overly susceptible. I think one context I've seen this in is, you know, these stories of these chatbots that are so intent on giving you the kind of feedback you like that they start mm-hmm. reinforcing, you know, driving you into a spiral of self-delusion or paranoia or whatever. And so, you know, and I do think it's going to be a big thing. And these AIs, they're just going to be, I think most people still don't understand what's about to happen. And I don't know how soon it'll happen, but they're going to be more and more influential. They already have demonstrated amazing persuasive powers just in argumentation. And remember, on social media, you don't know who's a real person and who's a bot, at least the way things are structured now. And they're going to have incentives to get you to buy things, or if they're in the hands of powerful people, maybe get you to believe certain things. So it's, it's about building up resilience. And one approach to it is, I would say, kind of mindfulness, like just Be aware of how your feelings are subtly making you respond in certain ways to certain influences. You know, try to preserve a little equanimity and detachment, and so on. But the sovereignty is with respect to the encroachment of algorithmic influence.
Have you heard about, by the way, ChatGPT Pulse? We haven't talked about that. I haven't looked into it, but it sounds eerie. A new feature that allows ChatGPT to message you proactively.
Yeah, we should talk about that. I have a take, not original, but urgently important, and America must hear it. Unfortunately, it's going to happen on the other side of the paywall, Nikita.
Okay. I can tell you a story about visiting a prison in Vilnius, which I recently did on the other side of this paywall.
Okay. Well, anyway, people can, if you're a paid subscriber to Non-Zero Newsletter, link is in the show notes or in YouTube, and right, and it's everywhere, isn't the link?
It's everywhere.
Or if you just go to Non-Zero, the Non-Zero Newsletter at nonzero.org, you'll see a post for this issue. And if you click on that, you'll see that to get to the overtime part of that, you're going to need to get past the paywall as a way to do it. And then you can also just set up your podcast feed so that you don't have to mess with that again if you listen by audio podcast.
That's right. If you become a paid subscriber, just listen in Substack app and you're fine.
Yep. Plus, you get in on our very special Zoom calls. And at some point, if this Discord thing evolves to a point where there's a special channel for special people, you'll be one of the special people. But right now, the Discord is originally, we're going to start with it just open for discussion, right?
Yeah, we're starting. We should say a few words about this. So Danny Fessner is going to, we decided there are going to be meetups. We haven't yet figured out what exactly they're going to be about, what shape they'll take. The most popular, I think, suggestion for now is a book club. And the most popular suggestion for a book is Yudkowsky's AI.
If anyone kills it, everyone dies. Yes.
That's right. But there can be a million of other things that we do, different kinds of online meetups, in-person meetups, clandestine propaganda operations, to be a part of that conversation. Mm-hmm. To discuss what it is that we want to be doing, click on that link in the video description, join the Discord server, and we'll talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks, everybody, whether or not you're going to join the other special people in overtime. But you really should.